Welcome back. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. December 1st marked the 60th anniversary of the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott. To honor that, we're listening back to an interview I did with Jean Theo Harris about her book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Enjoy. Welcome, everybody. This is Mark Steiner, and we're about to have a conversation with Dr. Jean Theo Harris, who's a professor of political science at Brooklyn College, the University of New York. She's an author, and she writes many things around the black freedom struggle and politics of race in America. Her book, which is a groundbreaking book in many ways, is The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. And Jean Theo Harris, welcome. Good to have you on the air with us.
It's great to be here.
So, may I call you Jean?
Please.
Please. So this is an important book because we have this, even though people have said, you know, she was, the whole question of her not being tired and has kind of been put aside by many, the real legacy of Rosa Parks is not known. I mean, which is why I think you wrote this book, right, to set the record straight about who this woman was.
Absolutely. I mean, I think certainly, you know, many people, you know, many people have gotten us beyond the, you know, the tired seamstress.
Right.
But again, much of what we know, if you ask people to recite it, it's, oh, she was secretary for the NAACP, she went to Highlander. And then, but not much past that. And then so even what it meant to be the secretary of the NAACP and how she was a secretary of the NAACP, because she did it very differently than many people did it. What it was she did at Highlander, she went to a two-week workshop on school desegregation to plan, you know, to try to plan for the implementation of Brown, right? That even the substance of the things that we know, right, haven't really been fleshed out. And I really argue in the book that in many ways Mrs. Parks has been simultaneously honored and exalted and then relegated to be a kind of children's book hero.
Right, right.
And so we haven't had, I mean, unfortunately, my book is the first serious scholarly monograph on her, which is incredible, again, given, you know, how important she is, how regarded she is, how known she is, right? That when I first started it, the idea that there wasn't, you know, one, if not many, again, scholarly treatments of her. I mean, we have dozens of King, we have hundreds of Lincoln, and none of her, you know, smaller works, children's books, young adult books, but again, not for sort of serious adult, you know, and scholarly readers.
And I, the idea that, that this is a book really in some ways of a larger history of a woman of resistance, whose
yes.
life was about resistance before
yes.
the Montgomery boycott.
Yes. And I think if you look at her life, it's really a story of the black freedom struggle in the 20th century.
Right.
And really takes us from, I mean, her grandfather's a Garveyite, so our story really begins there. Right. I mean, you know, her earliest political influences are in her family, and particularly her mother and her grandfather. So we start the story with Garveyism and with Southern Garveyism, which I think is not so known to people.
No, because most people think of it as a Northern movement with Marcus Garvey, not about the South.
Absolutely. And then her adult political life starts with meeting and marrying Raymond Parks, and Raymond Parks was working on the Scottsboro case. And so that, you know, that's kind of where she gets her start. You know, in the beginning, in their relationship, he's the more public activist. You know, she's sort of helping. He's, you know, he's taking a lead in this Scottsboro organizing. Obviously, that's going to change over the course of their marriage and their lives. She will become the more public activist. He will do more behind-the-scenes work. So we go from Scottsboro. She joins the goes to her first NAACP branch meeting in 1943, in part because she wants to register to vote. This is during World War II. She is actually elected secretary that very first day. She's the only woman there. Shortly after that, E.D. Nixon, who is one of the more stalwart activists of the branch, she's a sleeping car porter, very active in the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. He's doing a lot of the organizing around voter registration. He comes to her apartment to bring her some materials. You know, that really, you know, that meeting and that partnership that will develop really is going to change the face of American history. And basically, Nixon and Parks are going to kind of set about and change the Montgomery branch into a much more activist branch over the objections of many kind of middle-class members of the branch. So if you actually, if you go to D.C. and you look at the Library of Congress and the BLACP papers in the Library of Congress, there are many people who kind of object to what Nixon and Parks are doing. Nixon is elected president in 1945, I should say that. And so in those years after 1945, as they're trying to make it a more political active branch, they come, you know, there's some controversy about that. They will come to lead the Alabama Conference at the NAACP in the late 40s. So this is all, right, this is the decade before, again, her historic bus stand, which is December 1st, 1955.
And that, to me, is the incredible part. Taking us even back, what you mentioned, the Scottsboro Boy, this trial in the 1930s of these young black men who were falsely accused of rape taken off of a freight train when they were riding during the Depression.
Right.
And this is Alabama we're talking about, and in Alabama, and she and her husband Raymond, it was almost as if this was their wedding present. This was their honeymoon, fighting the Scottsboro Boys for their freedom.
And this is extremely dangerous, right? Raymond talks about he would, like, stand on street corners and he would tie his shoes certain ways to signal, like, what time they were going to meet. I mean, they meet in the middle of the night. You know, she describes one late night meeting at their house, you know, with guns all over the table, right? Because this is so scary, this kind of organizing, that they're, you know, and the kind of pressure and violence brought to bear on people organizing. So this is... You know, again, this is where our story begins with her as an adult. You know, and with, again, the long history of self-defense in black communities in the South in particular, with a kind of, you know, a grassroots organizing, right? She will then bring that, and they will do that within the NAACP in the 1940s. A lot of the work that she and Nixon are doing in the 1940s are investigating and trying to document either cases that involve white brutality against black people, you know, white sexual violence against black women, or, you know, these kind of legal lynching cases. And so she's kind of trying to press for justice around a number of cases in the late 40s and 50s. And this is also very dangerous work, and she's traveling Alabama to do this. So, right, it's a very different view of kind of how we're going to get to 1955 and all of the work that goes into both getting, you know, I mean, if we sort of think about her courage, like kind of what it, all of the kind of gathering of frustration and community and bravery, right, that goes into that night and that goes into the movement that will come out of her stand, right, that takes years of marinating in some sense.
This leading up to December 1st, 1955, when Rosa Parks made this stand, and we can clear up some of the history here about where she actually sat in the bus. But also, before we get there, the role of Emmett Till's brutal murder in Mississippi, and her going to this place called the Highlander School, which we should talk about in a moment as well, how this kind of made her militancy even grow stronger. So talk a bit about Emmett Till first and how that played into this.
Well, I think Emmett Till plays in a couple of different ways. So Emmett Till is murdered, right, in August. He is a 14-year-old from Chicago, goes to visit his uncle in Mississippi to, you know, spend part of the summer there. He says something to a white woman. Her husband and brother-in-law come and kidnap him and torture him and kill him. His mother then allows an open casket funeral and pictures of his mutilated body to be taken by Jet Magazine. This has a searing effect on many people across the country, including Rosa Parks. And then, interestingly, one of the things I discovered was that 4 days before her bus stand, they'd actually had a big mass meeting in Montgomery. One of the organizers around kind of getting the word out about the Till case, a man by the name of T.M. Howard, had begun a kind of a road tour in the wake of the two men being acquitted, right? So Emmett Till's killers are put on trial, and then they are acquitted. And so T.M. Howard is traveling around doing, you know, trying to raise awareness of this. And so 4 days before her bus stand, she actually goes to a mass meeting. So Emmett Till is fresh in her head that night on the bus. So she talks about thinking about him in those minutes on the bus, and I think that is likely true, given that this had happened not just over the summer, but it was kind of fresh in her head from these testimonies 4 days earlier.
And then there's the Highlander School. Mm-hmm. And her going up to this workshop on school desegregation and confronting for the first time a place where really radical whites and blacks are gathering to fight segregation together. This mm-hmm. blows her mind.
Yes. So she goes on the suggestion of Virginia Durr. Virginia is a white kind of civil rights supporter, one of the few in Montgomery. And Rosa Parks is sewing for her at night and is, as we were talking about before, increasingly discouraged, increasingly burned out. So Durr actually recommends that Rosa Parks go to Highlander in part because her spirits are pretty low, you know, that they've been trying things and largely, you know, they have not really gone anywhere. So she takes off 2 weeks of work, which is a significant amount of time, right, for a working class person like Rosa Parks to go in August to a 2-week workshop at Highlander Folk School. Highlander had been started in the 1930s. It's an adult kind of organizer training school. Sort of seeking to cultivate, you know, leadership skills, organizing skills, the idea being that local people are the best suited to lead their own communities. But again, you need those skills and training to do so. By the 1950s, they're turning their attention to civil rights. And in particular, this is 1955. So we've had Brown versus Board of Education in 54. But the Supreme Court puts off the implementation of Brown, right, a year, what legal scholars often call Brown 2, right, where we get that historic language with all deliberate speed, where the court basically turns the implementation back to the states, puts no timetable. And so what many activists realize, like Miles Horton, who runs Highlander, like Rosa Parks, is there's going to be no implementation unless people fight for it and demand it, that there's it's not going to happen, right? And so she's gone to this workshop to talk about, you know, making a plan for implementing school desegregation. And she talks about being very scared going there. You know, it's an all-white county. She's only seeing white people, and so that's very, that's scary.
Yeah, yeah.
She gets there, and it is, Highlander had been an interracial space, an integrated space. It's about half black and white, the workshop she attends. She talks about it being the first time she could speak, you know, her opinions in front of white people kind of openly without hostility. She talks about one of the best things about it was that she would wake up in the morning and she would smell breakfast and she would know that white people were making it for her.
Right, right.
And so she sort of loved that. She loved the matter-of-factness of the integration at Highlander. She had been in other kind of integrated groups before, but she said she always felt so black, right, that this was a much more run-of-the-mill, matter-of-fact, like this is just how things are done. So it very much raises her spirits, right? There's 48 people there. There are other people thinking about these issues, committed to these issues. That said, the last day, like any good organizer training school, they do a go-around, what are you going to do when you get home kind of thing. And they get to Rosa Parks, and Rosa Parks says, well, there's never going to be a movement in Montgomery. It's the cradle of the Confederacy. Resistance is too high. Violence is too high. And black people aren't unified. So we're never going to have a movement. So I'm just going to go and continue to work with the young people. She had actually refounded the youth branch of the chapter. And again, she'd always been sort of seeing young people as sort of the way forward. So this is Rosa Parks in August, right? She's saying there's never going to be a movement. It's not going to happen. So she's just going to keep working with the young people. And again, I think that speaks to both the, you know, kind of both her fortitude, right? That, like, she says this, and yet she continues to do what she does, right? And that also, that evening in December is in many ways about a personal line for her. It's not that she knows something, that history is about to change. It's not that she knows that a movement will happen. She does not at all believe that a movement's going to happen out of her stand. She's making her stand because it's, you know, the bus driver has crossed a line for her.
And so in the few minutes we have left in this segment, here we are. Paint very quickly the picture of what happened on the bus. But then I want to spend a good deal of time in our next segment talking about the vivid portrait you paint of what the boycott was like. But she is in the bus, sitting in the middle section, not in the white section, and dragged off.
Basically, one white man is left standing. The bus fills up. The bus driver says, all four people, that's the way Alabama segregation works, will have to get up so this one white man can sit down. And she refuses to do so. She says she's been pushed as far as she could be pushed. She talks about this. She would be consenting to this treatment. She doesn't consent. And then she also talks about, again, this is in our interviews, that this was, she was in some sense being asked to do something that she'd been asking of others. So she sees this within an organizing tradition too, this moment. And so she refuses. She is ultimately arrested. She believes the police didn't want to arrest her, that it's the bus driver that really pushes it, that they just want to evict her. So again, James Blake also acts in sort of historic ways that night. She is arrested and taken to jail. And then bailed out ultimately by Nixon, the Durs, and her husband. And they go back to her apartment to discuss sort of what's next. Because Nixon, after he finds out that she's okay, is delighted in many ways, because here is the kind of test case that they've been looking for. She's 42. She's married. She's active in her church. She occupies this interesting class status. She's working class, but sort of middle class in demeanor, and she's brave. And so he trusts she's not going to flinch under the pressure. So for all those reasons, she is kind of the test case that he and many people have been looking for.
And Gene, take us to, so they're home and they're playing this one-day boycott, but everything from the way you describe the creation of these thousands, tens of thousands of leaflets, mm-hmm. to how the boycott exploded, to the organizing of the kind of alternative transportation system. Tell that story about paint that picture for us.
Right. Well, I mean, I think this is a community rising up, right? There is Rosa Parks' individual courageous stand, but what makes it a movement is not her, is all of these people, right? That start to act in those hours after she is arrested. So she decides she's willing to be this test case. She calls Fred Gray, he's a young lawyer in town, to tell him to ask if he'll represent her. He actually calls Joanne Robinson, who's the head of the Women's Political Council, a professor, and it's the Women's Political Council who calls for this one-day boycott. Robinson and two students sneak into the college in the middle of the night, run off 35,000 leaflets. Joanne Robinson calls Nixon in the middle of the night to tell him of their plans. Nixon then early that morning gets on the phone, starts calling ministers because he knows the ministers are going to have to preach about this to have any hope that people will stay off the buses on Monday. He calls a young minister in town, a new one by the name of Martin Luther King, right? So this is how we get Martin Luther King. At first, he wakes King up. It's 6 in the morning. King hesitates a bit. Nixon calls him back. Nixon wants to use King's church, which is very centrally located, to have this meeting to talk about plans. Ultimately, King says yes. Everybody's nervous that weekend, right? There's all of this organizing and planning, but people are very nervous. Are people going to stay off the bus on Monday? And so Rosa Parks talks about kind of in some sense the most glorious moment of the whole boycott for her is that first morning and realizing that people had, in fact, stayed off the bus, that people had, in fact, stayed together. Like you said, this is just a one-day boycott they're calling for at first. But it is out of the power of that day. And a huge mass meeting held that night that people decide to continue on indefinitely. Then we see the organization of this kind of amazing carpool system. I think some of our, you know, we often think about the Montgomery bus boycott just about people walking, and certainly people walked. But part of how you have a year-long boycott like they had is that they set up these 40 checkpoints across Montgomery, and people would pick people up and drive people across town, right, to work, to shopping, to doctors. That this is partly how a whole community could stay off the buses for 13 months, which is how long the boycott will finish in December 20th, 1956, after the Supreme Court rules against Montgomery's bus segregation. And so the buses are desegregated.
And I think this is an important part of this as well, is while Mrs. Rosa Parks became the star of the movement, raising money across the country, this was an extremely difficult time for Rosa Parks and her husband, Raymond. Extremely
yes.
difficult.
Yes. She loses her job 1 month in. Raymond also is forced to resign his job when the he works at the barbershop at the Air Force Base, and they forbid any discussion of the boycott or that woman. So he resigns his job. So basically, about one month in, they have no steady income. They never find steady work again in Montgomery. So she spends that year largely going across the country, fundraising for the movement, turning this local struggle into a national movement, at the very same time that her own family is in serious economic trouble. And her own family is getting, you know, regular death threats and hate calls, so much so that her mother takes to sort of talking on the phone for hours just to keep the phone line busy, right? So the toll it takes on Rosa Parks' family, on her health, on Raymond's health, is significant. It lasts far beyond that year. I talk about it as really a decade of suffering, right? They don't have... 8 months after the boycott, they still can't find steady work. They're still getting death threats. They leave Montgomery for Detroit, where her brother is. She will spend more than half of her life in Detroit. She calls Detroit the promised land that wasn't. And so she spends that half of her political life fighting the Jim Crow North, sort of challenging the racism and jobs and housing and schooling and policing that she finds in Detroit, that she sees as not too much different than the systems of discrimination, jobs, housing, schools, and policing that she had left in Montgomery. And I think that's another surprising part of the story.
Yeah, right? I'm sorry. And we only have a few minutes left here, Dr. Theo Harris. So let's take those few minutes and kind of really jump into Detroit, Conyers, Malcolm, her fight against the war. Not much time, I know, but let's let the people hear a bit about that.
So in 1964, she's volunteering on the kind of upstart campaign of a young civil rights lawyer by the name of John Conyers, who's running on a jobs, justice, and peace platform. Conyers is very pro-labor, like Rosa Parks is. Conyers is an early opponent of kind of U.S. Militarism and U.S. involvement in Vietnam, as Rosa Parks is. He is not favored, but she's sort of supporting him. He's sort of probably the most sort of... radical in the bunch. There are eight people running. It's a new congressional seat. She actually prevails on Martin Luther King to come to Detroit on Conyers' behalf. King really stays away from this kind of political work almost exclusively, but can't say no to Rosa Parks. So he comes. Conyers attributes this partly then to he wins the primary by about 40 votes. So it's an extremely close primary. So King's it probably was important to that. One of the first things Conyers does is he hires Rosa Parks to work in his Detroit office, you know, doing constituent work, you know, kind of being his, you know, partly his presence in the community. Right? This is the first paid political job she has. This is 1965. She's been doing this kind of political work for more than two decades, and yet this is her first paid political position. And so she's also on the ground, right, both working for Conyers and sort of also in her sort of political life outside, as a kind of rising, you know, militancy in the city and across the country, right, kind of takes hold, and she sort of takes part in and alongside a growing Black Power movement in Detroit and nationally. As you noted, Rosa Parks calls Malcolm X her personal hero.
Right.
Which, again, I think is sometimes surprising, right, that Rosa Parks, I think, looking at her political life and looking sort of, she refuses these dichotomies we often make between King and Malcolm, between the NAACP and, right, Black Power, right? Rosa Parks, you know, works with, takes part in all of these different kinds of movements. Ella Baker, Queen Mother Moore. So by the late 60s, right, she is very active in kind of the opposition to the Vietnam War. She is going to both things locally in Detroit, the Shrine of the Black Madonna, and then also national kind of Black Power things. She attends the National Black Power Convention in Philadelphia in 68. She goes to the Black Political Convention in Gary in 1972. She's working on behalf of many kind of Black candidates that are first Black candidates for mayor, for in both in Detroit and nationally. She supports many kind of political prisoner campaigns in the 70s. Again, we can think about Angela Davis, the RNA 11, the Wilmington 10, right? She is steadfast on the issue of criminal justice. Right, so this is a Rosa Parks that's much more kind of politically varied and robust than I think the picture we often have of her.
This is wonderful, Dr. Jean Theo Harris, and the book is The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Sianna Greaves, Manifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast The Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to it via your favorite podcasting app. For your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Have a great weekend. Take care. Hold on. Hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Paul and Silas began to shout. Doors popped open and all walked out. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.